Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. There are probably a lot of folks who will know at least some of the basic details surrounding the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. This morning, though, we have a story that probably will be new to a lot of people listening, an odd story about an attempt. This was in 1876 by a gang of counterfeiters based in Chicago, an attempt to steal and hold for ransom the body of Abraham Lincoln. The plan was to steal him from his tomb in Springfield, to collect as much cash as they could, and also to ransom one of their fellow counterfeiters who at the time was in prison. It's a very interesting story, an odd story, but a very interesting one. And to talk about it this morning, we have as our guest Thomas Crogwell. He's the author of a recently published book that explores this and other elements of history of the time. The title of his book is Stealing Lincoln's Body, and it's published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. It is out in bookstores now. It officially has been out now just for about 10 days or so, and we're pleased that he could spend some time with us here talking about the story. He is the author also of several books on Catholic history and American popular culture, including Saints Behaving Badly, The Wisdom of the Popes, and Urban Legends, and he's joining us by phone. As we talk, as always, questions are welcome from people who are listening. All we ask is people just are brief so that we can move along and get in as many people as possible. But of course, listeners are welcome to call 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455 at any point. If you have questions, comments, you can call. Mr. Crogwell, hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks, and yourself?
Happy to be here. Good. By the way, call me Tom. It makes it easier.
All right. Well, I appreciate you giving us some of your time. This is a story that I'm sure will be new to a lot of people. Perhaps people who live in Springfield would know it as part of the city's history.
Right.
But that for a lot of other people, it will be a new story, and it is an interesting and an odd story.
You can say that again.
Both. Well, just to begin, The question of where Lincoln would be buried was contested virtually from the moment that he died.
Yes.
Because the battle here, the partisans were initially people in Washington who wanted to see him buried in Washington, D.C.,
uh-huh.
and Mary Todd Lincoln, who wanted him buried in Springfield. And then there was a late, we'll go on to the next step about where in Springfield, but in all of this, Mary Todd Lincoln prevailed. How is it that she managed to prevail in that first battle when I'm sure that there were a lot of people who felt that the thing to do would be to have a monument put up and have Lincoln rest in the nation's capital?
That's true. And in fact, they had a place already picked out. A lot of congressmen and senators wanted him put in a vault that had been prepared for George Washington. It was right underneath the rotunda, the Capitol Dome. But George didn't use it. George and Martha wanted to be buried together out at Mount Vernon. So it was still lying there empty. Mary Lincoln didn't want that place because it was a one-man vault, and Abraham was not going any place that she wasn't going later.
Mm-hmm.
So she was absolutely determined that the two of them would be buried in the same tomb or monument or plot, and she was backed up by her son, Robert, and also, as it turned out later, by Secretary of War Stanton, and the congressman had enough respect for the widow's wishes to back down when she made her wishes known.
And she wanted him buried in Springfield and had in a particular place in mind.
Yes.
What's interesting is that apparently I think this is true, the very day Lincoln died, at that day, there were a group of people in Springfield who organized to have a monument constructed, and that the city fathers there in Springfield, they knew that people would come to the grave, to visit the grave.
Right.
And
right.
They thought, well, the thing to do is to put it in downtown Springfield, obviously, but also there, Mary Todd Lincoln, she had another idea.
Right. She wanted Oak Ridge Cemetery, which is about 3 miles outside of downtown Springfield. It's what's called a rural cemetery. It differed from the traditional churchyard and burial grounds that were inside city limits. It was much more like a park. And if you go there today, there's still that park-like quality. It's full of beautiful plantings of trees and shrubs and flowers, and it's landscaped, and there's hills and valleys. It's really lovely. And Mary liked this place, and she wanted Lincoln out there. The town fathers, who called themselves the National Lincoln Monument Association, as you said, wanted him in the heart of town, because at this time, 1865, Springfield was a pretty sleepy place. It was about 12,000 people, and when they realized that Lincoln was coming back to be buried in the hometown, they also imagined that he would be a tremendous draw, that Springfield would become this national destination, and that would bring business and residents and money, and they thought if they put him right in the middle of downtown, as you said, it would just make it so much easier. To get out to Oak Ridge at that time, you know, there were no taxis, so you'd have to have hired carriages or maybe build a trolley line. It just seemed like way too much trouble.
Did she actually say that that Mr. Lincoln had said he wanted to be buried at this particular place, or was it that he just, there was at some point they were walking along through the countryside and he just said something like, I would like to be buried in some place like this?
Well, see, that's an interesting story, because the earliest account of that, that towards the end of his life, he and Mary were out in rural Virginia, and they went by a charming little country cemetery. And he told her, you know, Mary, you're younger than I am. You'll outlive me. When I'm gone, bury me in a quiet place like this. Mm-hmm. But Mary didn't tell that story until 10 or 11 years after the assassination. So she made no reference to Lincoln in her correspondence with the people of the Monument Association. It was purely, I'm the widow, I say where he's going.
Yeah. This, and it turns out that, of course, there now in Springfield, there are a number of sites that are involving Abraham Lincoln that mm-hmm. you can go and see. You can go see the house where he lived. Now, of course, we have the Lincoln Library and Museum. You can go to the tomb. There are a bunch of you can go to New Salem. So there are a lot of interesting things to see around there. So a lot of people do go, and you can actually spend a couple of days if you want looking at Lincoln things in Springfield. So it turns out, though, that in a sense the city fathers were vindicated, at least in this notion that people would come to observe his memory, see places related to him. Apparently now Oak Ridge is among the most visited cemeteries in the entire country.
Second most visited cemetery in the United States. Arlington, of course, is the first.
Wow. And I would assume that is for only one reason, because Abraham Lincoln is buried there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, there are other interesting – a lot of Lincoln's in-laws and neighbors and business partners are also buried in Oak Ridge, but it's pretty much – it's one-stop shopping. People come in, they go see the Lincolns, they go on to the next site. But 400,000 people come every year.
Mm-hmm. The monument. So they did indeed build this monument, and Mary Todd prevailed here again over the wishes of the city fathers, who wanted it in downtown Springfield. She said it was my way or nothing, and then she got her wish. She had the kind of leverage, so the decision was made to construct this monument and to build it at Oak Ridge. But it did actually take a while. There was a temporary tomb where the body lay, and actually that's still there. You can see it. It's right. It's very near the monument. But then it took several years, I think, before the monument itself was actually completed and his remains were put there.
Right. He died, of course, in 1865, and the tomb was ready in 1874. And initially, at the funeral, he was put in what's called the receiving vault, and it had been built when they built the cemetery in the 1850s. If someone died during the winter and the ground was frozen, they could keep the coffin there. if someone died and the family didn't have a burial plot or hadn't built their mausoleum yet, you could keep the coffin there until the place was ready. So Lincoln and his son Willie were both in this receiving vault, and it is there. It's right at the bottom of the hill behind the Lincoln Monument. And then there was another little temporary tomb, private, just for the Lincolns, while the major monument was going up. You can see the site of it. There's a little gray stone on the slope of the hill below the monument that's there now that shows you the location of that place. So he was moved around a lot.
Yeah. So I guess I misunderstood that little the temporary the place where he had spent some time, that was not constructed for that purpose. That was not specifically a Lincoln thing. That was a cemetery thing. Yes. That had been there, and as you say, that was a place where if the ground was too hard, you couldn't dig. You had to put someone somewhere.
Right.
That was the place that they went.
Right. And it's still there. You know, you can still go down and take a look at it.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Thomas Crogwell, and he is the author of the book Stealing Lincoln's Body, and it is about the plot in 1876 to steal the body of Abraham Lincoln from his tomb in Springfield and hold it for ransom. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, let's go on, and we can talk a little bit about the plot itself and the people who were involved, and apparently the man behind this plot was a counterfeiter, a man named Big Jim Kennelly.
Right.
A Chicago guy, Irish-American guy from Chicago, who was in a number of businesses, both legal and illegal. Tell us about Big Jim.
Well, he was an immigrant from Ireland. He was probably famine Irish. You know, all of those immigrants who came over in the 1840s, which is actually when the Crogwells showed up, too. And he had a small counterfeiting business that was mostly in Illinois, spilled over a little bit into St. Louis and maybe into Indiana. He was, in spite of his name, Big Jim, he was really small potatoes. But he had one very valuable asset. He had one of the best counterfeiting engravers in the country working for him. The man's name was Benjamin Boyd. His counterfeit money was so good it was virtually undetectable. And consequently, Big Jim and the other members of his ring made a lot of money. But there was another Irishman named Patrick Tyrrell who was a member of the Secret Service. And the Secret Service at this time did not protect the president. The Secret Service had been organized to hunt down counterfeiters. And Patrick Tyrrell wanted to get Benjamin Boyd, and he finally tracked him down, found so much evidence against him that when Boyd went to trial, the court sentenced him to 10 years at the penitentiary in Joliet. And with Boyd gone, Big Jim's supply of high-quality counterfeit money dried up. Mm. So he was trying to think, how could he get Boyd out of prison? He didn't have political connections. He didn't have a type of political muscle. And somehow, and this is one of the mysteries of the story, we don't know how it popped into his little head, but somehow he came up with the idea of stealing the thing that the United States held most sacred, the body of Abraham Lincoln, and holding it for ransom. And at first he only wanted Boyd out in exchange, but then he thought, well, as long as I've got Lincoln's body, I might as well go for the brass ring. So eventually the deal was release Boyd and give us $200,000 in cash, and you get the body of Lincoln back unharmed.
Yeah, so it was cash and a player to be named later as part of the deal. That it seems such a strange idea. Is there some precedent for someone plotting to steal the body of a celebrated American like this?
Well, you know, there was a freaky case in Mount Vernon in the 1830s where George Washington's nephew had fired one of the gardeners, and the gardener got mad and came back that night and went into the family tomb and thought he had stolen some of the bones of George Washington. Actually, it was not even one of the Washingtons; it was one of their in-laws. But he wasn't going to make a ransom offer. He just wanted to do something to strike back at the Washington family. There's another story. John Carroll Power, who was the custodian of the tomb at the time of the break-in, tells this mysterious story that in the 1860s, there was a rather eccentric lawyer in Springfield going around saying that he was going to steal Lincoln's body and take it down to Mexico and somehow, you know, make this would be the final blow in defense of the Confederacy. But Power gives no names. We've never been able to track down who he was possibly talking about. He's the only person who ever mentions this earlier plot. There's nothing in the newspapers from the time. That's another one of the mysteries. But it does seem that maybe this was just something that popped into Big Jim's head. Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I guess sort of a wrinkle here that's takes us down a side street, but I hadn't really realized it, and I learned this only by reading one of the reviews of the book, is that actually John Wilkes Booth, before hitting on this plan to assassinate Lincoln, actually initially planned to kidnap him.
Yes, that's right. That was one of the ideas that Booth had. And actually, you know, it would have been very easy. Lincoln was very sloppy about his personal security. For example, he came with a not very attentive bodyguard to Ford's Theater. And when he would go back and forth from the White House to the Soldiers' Home, which was on the outskirts of Washington, sort of his favorite little peace and quiet retreat, he often traveled alone. And there was one time when he was riding along this, you know, this deserted country road, heading back into Washington, somebody took a shot at him and knocked the top hat off his head.
Well, so Big Jim Canale had this idea that he would steal Lincoln's body, would hold it for ransom, would get cash, and also would get the release of this man, Ben Boyd,
right,
his favorite and highly skilled engraver in counterfeiting. So he had some associates in Logan County, which is adjacent to Sangamon County, so that's not that far away, who he enlisted initially in the effort to do this, steal the body. And apparently they went out there and kind of cased the place, took a look at the tomb, and said, oh, well, no problem. One of the things that that kind of surprises me is that it seems that there was so little in the way of security for the tomb, so that all they really would have had to do, at least initially, was to break a padlock, and they would be in to the place where the body was.
That's true. There was no night watchman out at the cemetery. There was no sexton who lived on the grounds. The custodian Power lived in downtown Springfield, so he was 2 to 3 miles away. The only security, as you said, was a single padlock on the tomb door. They just didn't think anybody was going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
It never occurred to them. There was body snatching that went on in the 19th century, but it was generally they would steal the bodies of the newly dead and sell them to medical schools so they could perform autopsies and study anatomy. Springfield did not have a medical school, so they didn't run into this problem. In other places like New York and Cincinnati, where there were lots of medical colleges, grave robbing was a serious problem, but Springfield hadn't run into it.
Yeah. So apparently these guys, the Logan County gang, said, okay, we can do this, and looked out at the tomb and thought, no problem here. And so apparently they were on the eve of doing this, or we're going to do this. And here's one of the many great stories in connection with this. One of the guys decided that he was going to celebrate.
Right.
And he went to a brothel in Springfield and spilled the beans to one of the women who worked there, who was a friend of who?
The chief of police of Springfield,
yes,
who by chance happened to be there too that night.
Who would have thought it?
And she passed the word along to the chief of police, and so when the guy sobered up the next morning, he realized what had happened, and they all packed up and left town.
Hmm.
So That didn't work out. Big Jim was not especially happy about that.
Well, he didn't give up, though, and
no.
He went back to Chicago, and he enlisted a couple of guys that he was involved with, were involved with counterfeiting, that he apparently thought would be more reliable.
Right. He was a silent partner in a saloon on the near west side of Chicago, a place called The Hub, and he went up there, saw his partner, Terrence Mullen, who ran the place, and Mullen's crony, a man named Jack Hughes. Again, these two are Irish immigrants, and told them what he wanted them to do. And they said this sounded easy. And, of course, the fact that there was $200,000 that the three of them were going to divvy up made it even more attractive.
Mm-hmm. And that in those days, that would have been a considerable amount of money.
Oh, my gosh, yeah, because you could rent a very nice apartment in Chicago for $5 a month. So $200,000 was a fortune.
Yeah. So once again here we had some people who were prepared to do it. They figured, oh, this is not going to be too tough. One of the interesting questions here, and they apparently had some sort of ideas. Well, one of the interesting questions is, well, okay, assuming that you do this, you manage to get Lincoln's body out of the tomb, what are you going to do with it?
Right. Well, they came up with this idea of putting it in the back of a wagon and driving it up to the Indiana Dunes and burying it there, which is sheer lunacy. Because, first of all, it's a 200-mile trip across open country. And you're not going to be able to make 200 miles in a horse and wagon in one day, obviously. So you're going to have to spend the night at a few places. And people are going to notice that there's a very fancy coffin in the back of your wagon. But this part did not occur to them. They thought this would be perfectly simple, and the Indians, for some reason, struck them as the place to hide it. It's another one of those. There's a Three Stooges and Keystone Cops element to this story, and this is we're now getting into the Three Stooges territory with the grave robbers.
Yeah, definitely. Well, here once again, they had the unfortunate bad luck that the authorities got word of the plot, and
yeah.
It happened because the man you talked about earlier, the Secret Service man whose job it was to track down counterfeiters, had an informant involved in the counterfeiting operation who got wind of the plot. These two guys, Mullen and Hughes, tried to enlist this third man in the plot, who apparently was just horrified,
yeah.
And went to the Secret Service guy and said, look, these guys are planning on stealing Abraham Lincoln's body.
Right. His name was Louis Swagels. He had ingratiated himself into the regulars at the hub. He was hanging out at the corner of the bar while Mullen and Hughes were talking about Big Jim had already left. And Mullen and Hughes were trying to figure out, well, we don't have any grave robbing experience. How are we going to pull this off? And Swagels overheard them and walked up and said, I'm the boss body snatcher of Chicago. And he, at this point, he did not know that it was Abraham Lincoln's body they were talking about. And they cheerfully revealed all the details and who they were going to go get. And as you say, he was horrified. But he had to wait. You know, you couldn't just get up and run out the door. He had to wait, probably have a few beers, make them feel comfortable, and then finally he was able to leave, and he made a beeline to Tyrrell's office in downtown Chicago and told him there are some counterfeiters who want to steal Lincoln's body.
Yeah. An amazing story. We're halfway through this part of Focus 580. We'll keep telling the story here. Our guest is Thomas Crogwell. He is the author of several books on Catholic history and American popular culture, and then the book that we're talking about here this morning. The title is Stealing Lincoln's Body, published by Belknap Press of Harvard University Press, and tells the story, and a lot of other things, too. It gives a lot of really rich detail of what American life was like at the time. So there's really you'll get this story in some more detail than we will discuss it here, but there's also a lot more. So if you're interested in 19th century American history, you might like to take a look at the book. Questions are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. So the Secret Service was on to these guys, Mullen and Hughes, and what they were going to do. And so they went out to the cemetery, and they were waiting for them.
Right.
And then the things just went downhill from there.
Yeah, pretty much. The Secret Service were waiting in the vestibule of the tomb, called Memorial Hall. And the tomb chamber was in the back of the tomb. And in 1876, there was no direct access from the vestibule to the tomb chamber. You had to walk out and go around on the outside to get in. So the Secret Service agents are in Memorial Hall. They've taken their boots off because they're afraid that they might echo on the marble floor. So they're all in their stocking feet, sitting in the dark, waiting. And at the back of the tomb are Mullen and Hughes and Swagels. You know, he's coming along because he's supposed to be in on the job. And they get there, and so you have three criminals, and none of them know how to pick a padlock. So they had to file through it, and it took about half an hour. And they got inside. They lifted the lid to again about how poor the security was. They had sealed the lid of the sarcophagus with plaster of Paris, not with cement. So it crumbled right away as soon as the grave robbers went at it with a crowbar. But the coffin fit so snugly into the sarcophagus, they couldn't get any purchase to lift it. So they sawed off the foot of the sarcophagus and started to drag it out. Well, it weighed 500 pounds. It was cedar wrapped in lead. And the three of them couldn't budge it. They got it about 15 inches outside of the sarcophagus and had to give up. So Swagels said he was going to go see if the wagon driver had arrived yet. But, of course, he didn't go looking for the wagon driver. He went around to the vestibule and tipped off the Secret Service agents, and they went running towards the tomb chamber to arrest the grave robbers.
Mm-hmm. And somebody's gun went off by mistake, and that tipped off the robbers. They ran away. Everybody was no doubt running around in the dark.
Right.
And it was a lucky thing that, in fact, that some members of the authorities here that were trying to arrest the grave robbers, it was a lucky thing that somehow they didn't manage to shoot each other.
Yeah, a little gun battle broke out among the detectives, among the law enforcement officers. Everybody was so spooked that they were literally shooting at shadows. And, of course, Mullen and Hughes got away. But it was not as huge a disaster as Tyrrell initially thought, because Mullen and Hughes made a beeline not only home to Chicago, but they went right back to the saloon, right back to the hub, where Tyrrell picked them up a couple days later.
Yeah. So eventually the two men, Mullen and Hughes, they were arrested, they were tried, they were found guilty, they were sentenced. So they did indeed do time for the attempted theft of the body of Abraham Lincoln.
Right.
We have a caller. Let's bring him into the conversation here.
Okay.
Someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I came in late, but I did hear David Inge say that you have books on the lives of Catholics in the 19th century. And I wonder if you could mention some of those other books. I'd be most interested in books on Catholics in Cincinnati, Ohio. Have you ever written anything on that?
No. I'm afraid I haven't written on Catholics in 19th century America. I've written a few books on saints. But I don't have anything on Catholicism in the 19th century, and I'm afraid nothing at all on the church in Cincinnati. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, I wasn't thinking of church history as I was thinking of the Catholic culture in Cincinnati in the 19th century.
No, that's not me. It's probably another author, but I'm afraid it's not the subject that I've tackled.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. I guess I will say again, I'm reading off the dust jacket here, that our guest has written some several books on Catholic history and American popular culture, as separate subjects, not those two things being linked, but the one thing and the other thing, including these books, Saints Behaving Badly, Wisdom of the Popes, and Urban Legends, and then also the book that we're talking about here, Stealing Lincoln's Body. Well, having had written on these other subjects, what was it about this particular story that that interested you and led you to take the time, do the research, and write a whole book about it?
Well, I just finished doing, I think it was a book on urban legends and another one on old wives' tales, and I was getting a little burned out on the popular culture titles. And I was complaining to my dad, saying, I've really got to come up with a, a book that's a little more interesting for me. And he said, why don't you write something about the Civil War? That's always popular. Or better yet, something about Lincoln. And it something clicked in the back of my head, because when I was 7 years old, the family went to Springfield, and we were standing in front of the tomb, and my dad told me that, you know, 100 years earlier, some grave robbers had tried to steal Lincoln's body and almost gotten away with it. So I started doing some research and realized that there hadn't been a full-blown account of the story since 1890, and was off and running from there. My father's very proud of himself that he was the inspiration, and he keeps asking me for a percentage of the royalties.
Yeah, well, he should, and you should at least, you know, take him out to dinner.
Well, yeah, that.
Something like that. Well, the story just sort of gets stranger and stranger as it goes along here. So we have the two men, Mullen and Hughes, they attempt unsuccessfully to steal the body of Lincoln. But apparently this act, the fact that it happened, so upset the men of the National Lincoln Monument Association, the men who felt responsible for Lincoln, for the body, for the monument, for the cemetery, everything, that they were so upset by this and so worried that they couldn't protect the body that in secret they went to the cemetery, they took out the coffin, they went down into the basement of the monument, they dug a hole, and they buried it.
Right. They put it in a shallow grave. It had to be shallow because Oak Ridge has a very high water table. So the deepest that they could go without the water bubbling up was about 2 feet. And, in fact, there was maybe 2 or 3 inches of dirt over the top of the coffin lid. And They put the sarcophagus back together. They had it patched up, and when visitors would come, they would say, you know, with a straight face, that Lincoln was in there perfectly safe. But they were very much afraid of copycat grave robbers who would be a lot smarter than Mullen and Hughes. So it was a genuine problem, and not only did they hide it down in the basement, but the first group were the gentlemen of the Monument Association who hid it down there. But then it was taken over by a group of just ordinary business people in Springfield, all in their 30s. There was a hotel clerk, there was a bank teller, there was a shopkeeper, and they called themselves the Lincoln Guard of Honor, and they dedicated themselves to keeping the secret of where Abraham Lincoln was buried, and there were 9 of them, and they treated it like a fraternal organization, like the Elks, like the Masons. But of course, the difference was that it was a closed membership; nobody else could come into it because this secret society had a secret worth keeping. To the general public, they presented themselves as a commemorative organization. They would throw little celebrations and anniversary ceremonies on Lincoln's birthday and on the death day. But the real thing was keeping the secret of where Lincoln was located. And they did tell Robert Lincoln. And Robert Lincoln was so touched that when Mary Lincoln died, he asked the men of the Lincoln Guard of Honor to bury her down in the basement too. And they might still be there except for one unexpected event, which was the tomb started to fall apart.
Yeah. And this periodically there were a couple of points where there had to be maintenance done, so then they had to do something with the bodies.
Yes, yeah, they hiding it was a headache. You know, I mean, initially when they took it down into the basement, they just covered it up with mildewed lumber and construction debris left over from when they were building the tomb. And as you say, you know, other workmen would come in, and Power, the custodian, had taken the foreman of one work crew aside and told him what was down in the basement and how this was a very sacred obligation, and made him swear on a stack of Bibles that he would never tell a soul. And, of course, within 24 hours, the workmen had blabbed it all over Springfield, which is why they had to go back and find a dry corner of the basement where they could dig a shallow grave.
Well, and apparently, even though the precise location in the basement where the body was buried was not known, that for a long, long time, it was rumored and said, at least around Springfield, people said, well, you know that sarcophagus, you know there's nothing in there.
Right, yeah. After the foreman blabbed, everybody in Springfield knew. And sometimes it leaked out a little bit beyond Springfield so that visitors were always asking Power when he was giving the tour, is he really in the sarcophagus? And Power would say, I can guarantee you that the body of Abraham Lincoln is 100% secure.
Mm, okay, well, that could give you a little wiggle room there.
Yeah, just a little.
And they no doubt took it to mean, yes, in fact, he's in the sarcophagus when he was not.
Right.
Let's talk to somebody else here. We have a caller on cell phone, line number one.
Okay.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hey, the question I had, I heard you mention that Abraham Lincoln had been shot through his hat on a trip back from something, and I was curious whether Abraham Lincoln carried a weapon and whether he was a marksman or not, and I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. I'm not aware that he carried a weapon with him. He must have known how to shoot because he grew up on the frontier, and of course he was also an officer. He was a captain in the militia during the Black Hawk War, so I can't imagine that he wasn't familiar with firearms. But I don't think he went around armed when he was president.
All right. Well, again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. So now, after the attempt to steal the body, and this was in 1876,
right.
The unsuccessful attempt, and then the men there in Springfield, starting with the Monument Association and then the Guard of Honor, were very concerned about security, and so they removed, you told the story, removed the body and buried it in the basement of the monument. It stayed there for something like 10 years. Is that right?
Longer. It stayed there till 1900.
Oh, okay. I guess I thought in 1887 it was moved to another location.
Okay.
Within the see that sometimes I get a little bit confused about some of the details of the story.
Well, yeah. Don't feel bad because sometimes I have to think twice to keep all of the movement straight. 1887. I'm going to hang fire on that one because. I've really drawn a blank. And, yeah, that is possible that there was yet another removal in 1880.
Okay. And then there was this later, the one that happened, was it around 1900?
Yes.
When they were moved just temporarily a little so that they could do this work on the monument. And then they were moved back, and it was put in a permanently sealed vault. They sealed it with concrete so that there would be no way in the world that you would, other than blasting through it, I guess, so you could actually get.
Right, so where Lincoln is now, the vault is 10 feet deep. The coffin was put in a steel cage and lowered into the bottom of this 10-foot hole, and then wet cement was poured over it. So it's a solid 10-foot by whatever block of cement with Abraham Lincoln down at the bottom of it.
Yeah.
This was according to Robert Lincoln's instructions, and he actually got the idea from how George Pullman of the Pullman Palace Cars,
mm-hmm.
That's how he had been buried, because Pullman, some of your listeners may know that Pullman, at the time of his death, was described as the most hated man in America.
Had a few enemies.
Yeah, had a few enemies. The way he broke up the Pullman strike was considered so cruel and so heartless that he was afraid that his grave would be desecrated and something would happen to his body. So he came up with this ultra-secure burial system, and Robert Lincoln adopted it.
Let's talk with someone else here in Chicago, line four. Hello.
Hello. I noticed what you had mentioned, that the man behind the plot for stealing Lincoln's body was a counterfeiter. And I found it kind of ironic because Lincoln was well known for having issued greenbacks. I don't know if you're familiar with the greenbacks currency issued directly by the government rather than going to private bankers who use that to finance the Civil War. And I'm wondering if any of, you know, the person Kennelly's counterfeiting was had involved greenbacks.
Well, I'm not sure how early Kennelly was involved in it. I'm pretty certain that it goes back to the Civil War era because, as you say, 1862, Lincoln signed off on the first national currency. And the counterfeiters really got their presses fired up after that. By the time the Civil War ended, they estimate about half of the paper money circulating in the North was bogus. So yeah, there is an ironic streak, as you point out, to Lincoln, who being a plot against Lincoln's body being hatched by counterfeiters.
Yeah, because you know it's there's even a theory that that's the reason behind Lincoln's assassination, that he refused to go to the private bankers for borrowing. He didn't want to pay that kind of interest, and I just found it really ironic that it would be a counterfeiter that ended up trying to steal his body too.
That's true. Well, I mean, it wasn't so much the issue of interest. It was that there wasn't enough gold and silver in the bank vaults of the North to cover the expenses of the Civil War. It was for an undertaking of that magnitude, the old-fashioned thing of paying cash on the barrelhead just wasn't going to work. So that's where they came up with the idea of using paper that was going to be backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government, as the saying goes.
Was there a gold standard at the time?
Yes.
Oh, there was a gold standard.
Yeah.
I see. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. My pleasure.
We have about 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Thomas Crogwell. His book is Stealing Lincoln's Body. It's about the plot in 1876 of, indeed, a gang of counterfeiters from Chicago to steal and hold for ransom the body of Abraham Lincoln. Questions welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Another amazing part of the story is that because of this, the moving the body around, at two different times, the casket was opened so that it could be definitely established, in case there was any doubt,
right,
that was in fact Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, they were the 1876 grave robbery attempt really spooked everybody involved with the maintenance and security of the tomb. And so at one of the removals, and that might have been the one in 1887, they opened the coffin to make sure it was him, and it was. And then in 1901, when the reconstruction of the tomb was finished, and they literally dismantled the whole thing, sunk new foundations, and rebuilt it. And in fact, they added 15 feet to the obelisk because in the original design, it looked just a little bit stumpy. But in 1901, without the approval of Robert Lincoln, they decided on their own volition to open up the box again and take one last look, because if they were going to seal him in tons and tons of wet cement, they wanted to make sure he was still there.
Yeah. And was this in this particular instance that one of the people that was, and there was a group of witnesses that looked at the remains, called in his son. He got him out of school,
right,
so that he could be there. And this man, his name was Fleetwood Lindley. He lived until 1963.
Yeah.
So he goes down in history as being the last person living to have seen the face of Abraham Lincoln.
That's correct. His father was one of the Lincoln Guard of Honor, Joseph Lindley. And he came up with this idea, sent a note off to the school, and told the teacher, please release my boy and tell him to get on his bicycle and pedal as fast as he could to Oak Ridge. And with all the enthusiasm of any kid let out of school early, he was like a bat out of hell, jumped off the bicycle at the tomb door and actually rolled it inside the tomb. And he gets there and he sees his dad and all these witnesses and Lincoln's coffin on a pair of wooden sawhorses. And suddenly he realizes what he's about to see. And there were two plumbers there, Leon Hopkins and his brother-in-law, Charles Willie. And they had been brought in to cut the lead sheath. And after they did, and they raised the lid, everybody in the room clustered around. And Fleetwood In 1963, Fleetwood Lindsley was tracked down by a reporter from Life magazine, and he told the Life magazine reporter that he wasn't scared at the time, but for the next 6 months he had Lincoln nightmares. But he said Lincoln was absolutely perfectly preserved, right down to the mole on the cheek and the tuft of beard on the chin. Nobody had any doubt that was Abraham Lincoln.
What an incredible experience that must have been. So he didn't, when he was called out of school, he had no idea what this was about. His dad just said, come on, get on your bike and get down to the cemetery as fast as you can.
Right, exactly. The tragic thing is that 3 days after that interview with the Life magazine reporter, Fleetwood Lindley died. So the last... we're lucky to have the report, but it's still a sad story.
Yeah. When the original event happened, the attempt to steal the body by Mullen and Hughes in 1876, was this a big news story?
Actually, in many places, no, because they stole the body on election night, and it was the notorious Hayes-Tilden election, which was sort of the forerunner of the 2000 Florida mess that we had. And the newspapers were dominated by the Hayes and Tilden recount and all the corruption that went with it, which was just unbelievable. I mean, that's a story on its own. So lots of papers didn't pick it up, or didn't pick it up until several days later. And then there were many papers, for example, the New Orleans Picayune and the Chicago Inter-Ocean, that dismissed it as a ridiculous rumor. And there was it even got, again, sounds very contemporary, the Republicans accused the Democrats of trying to steal Lincoln's body. Hmm. And it was an ugly mess.
Yeah.
But it got surprisingly short shrift in the national newspapers.
Well, you would think that something like this would be big news, but in view of what else was going on, and that was actually the reason that they chose that night, the guys who were going to try to steal the body, because they figured that because of the election, people would be consumed with that. Everybody would be in town.
Right.
The chances are that they could do this and do it without anybody seeing them.
Right. Nobody was going to notice a couple of strangers in town on the one day of the year when all the farmers come in to vote. And secondly, even if anybody, I doubt that there were ever nocturnal visits out to Oak Ridge, even under the best of circumstances. But on election night, everybody was going to be at the telegraph offices waiting for the returns to come in.
Yeah. The Secret Service hadn't gotten word of this plot, whether these guys could have pulled this off anyway. One of the issues, as you said, was that they didn't really realize how heavy the coffin was, that it weighed 500 pounds.
Right.
And even at the time when it was reburied in the basement, they had four or five guys who picked up the coffin and took it down there, and they had a hard time with it. You wonder whether, in fact, they could have actually managed it.
Yeah, you know, it's a big question. And then there's also the road trip of getting all the way up to the Indiana Dunes without anybody noticing that something funny is going on here. It's a peculiar story with lots of peculiar characters and odd little twists and turns. I don't think I've ever had so much fun researching a book in my life.
Who did they think was going to pay the ransom? Was it going to be the federal government? Was it going to be the state of Illinois? Who were they planning to present the demand to?
Well, they expected it was going to come from the state of Illinois. And this was the one part where they were clever. This was the one shining moment. They decided not to make the ransom offer themselves. They were going to keep themselves out of the picture. They were going to get word to Boyd through his wife that of what they were doing, and Boyd was supposed to tell the warden, and the warden was supposed to tell the governor. And they just assumed that from there, the governor would say, of course, we want Lincoln back. Here's your pardon, and here's $200,000 in cash, which is, you know, the triumph of optimism over experience, but okay.
Well, as you say, it's an amazing little story. and it told in rich detail with a lot of other information about just what life was like in America at the time.
It's a fascinating period. You know, between talking about the rise of the Secret Service and the effect of Irish immigration on the country and counterfeiting and money and embalming. You know, the Civil War pretty much made embalming common practice in the U.S.
Yeah. Well, the book is Stealing Lincoln's Body, and it's published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press by our guest Thomas Craughwell. And his last name, if you go looking for the book, is spelled Craughwell. Now, the book has just come out. I'm sure that you can find it in the bookstore. And Tom, thanks very much for talking.
David, I've had a lot of fun. Thank you.